Welcome to our latest Power Planner podcast. I'm really pleased to be joined by Rhys Edwards from Hampshire Hill, Rob Kingsbury from Professional Power Planner, and Sian Davies Cole again from Planworks and the Power Planner Club. Welcome, everybody. How are you all?
Great, thanks. Surviving tax year end.
Yeah, tax year end. I can't believe we're actually recording this 1 week before the end of tax year end, but thank you for putting the time aside. Much appreciated. And I thought we would take an opportunity to focus on the budget that we've just had and also reflect on the changes in the autumn statement with some of those tax changes coming into force from the start of the new year. And I say new year because I have 2 years, always celebrate two new years, the real new year and the tax new year on the 6th of April. So that comes from my short but 6 years where I started in HMRC, where I just love tax year starts and tax year ends. So obviously the big news was the abolition of the lifetime allowance and all associated pension changes. But before we get to that, I thought we should cover some of the other areas that power planners need to be aware of and some of the planning opportunities and restrictions as a result of the autumn statement as well. And I thought we'd start probably on the allowances and thresholds, because there are some changes coming in, but we know that they're frozen until the end of 2028. We know there's the reduction in the higher income level down to 125. And I think that's got some potential things that we need to think about. So I thought we'd start off with that. And who'd like to just give us a thoughts on things that you've been talking about recently about changes in that area? Rhys or Sian?
Oh, me. The interesting thing, you know, with the changes, particularly with the tax thresholds moving from 150 down to 125, there's going to be clients that we've all got that are going to be paying more tax, income tax specifically, if we start on that, and also dividend tax changes. Moving down to £1,000 in the next tax year and further the year after, but also increasing the rate at which they pay by 1.25% across the board. So people are going to be paying more income tax. Now, this few conversations that we've been having at Hampshire Hill, this could give rise to more people wanting to take the opportunity to go into tax efficient investment schemes. So looking at VCTs, EISs and SEISs, which have always been and probably always will be classified by the regulator as high risk products. But the importance of them as we move forward could increase, as if we're going to freeze tax thresholds, but wages are going up. And we're going to be pushing more people into the additional rate tax band. I just think it's something that perhaps, you know, we've been talking about it here, but we need to get comfortable with. There's plenty of experts out there that you can speak to, but getting to know the differences, the nuances between the three as well. Then have you got anything to add, Sian?
I mean, I couldn't agree more, Rhys, and a bit like you, I'm interested in this area. I've worked with it quite extensively with clients that have been investing in for the first time in VCT EIS, but also constant investors. So I'm really interested in this space, because if we look at it kind of a much higher level, we're talking about politics quite generally here. You know, it's politicians that decide all of these allowances and rates and who's going to pay more tax and things like that. But also, you know, EIS, VCT, they are a way of the government getting people to invest in growing companies and high earners. You know, they're earning a lot of money. They have spare cash. They are then recycling that money back into helping startups and getting a nice little tax break on it as well. I also think it's quite a nice way as well, because these are the clients that will have inheritance tax problems. EIS obviously gives you a business relief break, but also you've got other things as well, not necessarily what we're talking about with this, doing VCTs and EIS, but you've got AIM portfolios as well. For an experienced investor that's used EIS and VCT, that's another natural step that you could use with an ISA. Which is quite a nice way to then think about that forward planning, that legacy planning. Not while they're still working necessarily, but it gets them really comfortable with taking a higher level of risk other than a regular balanced portfolio, which it is something that they will probably need to consider. And I know you've probably seen the same where you've got high, high IHT issues with a client. They really want to tackle it, but they haven't invested significantly before in their life. They're already 70 and it's not going to be an option to go down that kind of route. So it's giving them more opportunity to experience that risk earlier in their life as well.
Yeah, and I think you're right in some of the two things that you've said there. I mean, obviously it comes with anybody that's listening to this, before you launch yourself down the EIS VCT route, obviously look at your PI covers that you have within your firms and look at your permissions as well, just to make sure that you're covered in doing them, is my little warning on that one. And again, that any tax planning or any tax efficient planning on the result of the freezing of allowances, I think again brings it more poignantly home. But I think you're right in sort of pointing out certainly those two main ones in the tax reducers. Looking at tax reducers, if you're not going to get the tax reliefs that you would have got previously, and I think you're right of saying EIS VCT, start to have a look at those. Look at the differences. There are some subtle differences in terms of how they're treated and the timelines as well. Maybe that's a conversation we can have on another podcast at a future date. The difference,
absolutely, and also Reese mentioned it earlier, but getting an expert on board is a key part of that as well. So most para planners, most financial planners, are not comfortable with looking at this, so they don't go near it because it is risky. It's risky business for the firm. It's risky to open up that conversation with a client if you haven't got experience in it. But there are plenty of people that do have experience in it. Para planners, other financial planners. You know, I think my experience definitely came from talking to, you know, BDMs and product providers. And there's some really great ones out there that will spend a lot of time with you to help you understand the ifs and the buts. And then once you understand it with one provider, you can then go to another and have a look at those. And you kind of can understand similarities between the different types of schemes, which is great.
Okay. The vehicles that have actually become more popular over the past couple of years as well, aren't they? Because I think there's some figures I've got here, say in 2021, 22, they've put 1.1 billion raised, which is 68% increase on the previous year. Yeah. So, you know, they are appealing to more people, and potentially not just high net worth people. But as you say, there are you know, caveats to using them.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, one thing that I would just say for picking up from what Sean said, if you can get a meeting with a BDM or with a provider of a VCT or an EIS, I can guarantee it'll be the most interesting webinar or whatever you do that you have that year, because of the type of investments that you're making and going into early stage company. Obviously, they get earlier and earlier as you go VCT, EIS, SEIS, but they're always very, very interesting investments and you're very involved in it. And I think that's a great story for clients. The other thing that I would just add as well is that there are, if you don't want to go down the route of VCTs yourself and researching them, there are options. There are certain wealth managers that will work with you and they will give the advice on the VCT and you would be a referrer, which can be a way if you're not comfortable doing it or if there's issues with your PI. Obviously still talk to PI before you start referring clients to anywhere else, but those options are available. So worth researching.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks.
It's a specialism for power planners as well, isn't it?
It's a great specialism. It is. If you're interested in it, then it's really great. Like for me, the investment bit is very much, I think of myself as a real financial planner. It's just a means to an end. And I'm not really interested in the fundamentals when it comes to, like, you know, investments and weeks and things like that, looking at all of the different data points. Whereas when you look at, you know, EIS and VCT, you're talking about businesses, you're talking about people, entrepreneurs. That's where I'm really interested. So it's deciding on what you're interested in. The tax bit for me is like the icing on the cake, because I love like tax stuff. So it's finding out what you are interested in, because there's no point in trying to make a specialism for yourself if you're forcing it, if it doesn't come naturally to you. And you'll just find the one that you'll talk to somebody else about and they'll go, oh God, I can't stand that. Oh, why are you interested in trusts? Oh God. And then you go, well, I'm really interested in it. So that's a great specialism to have.
Excellent. Okay. So we touched on the dividend allowances there, obviously the reduction of those. Again, just making sure, I suppose, from that perspective, is that you've got the right allocation, and that you're actually both using your allowances if you've got partners, you know, in either a civil partnership or married and whatever. So to just make sure you've got the right allocation, remembering that you can transfer between spouses without any CGT being risen as well. So, which brings me on to CGT. God grief, there we go. Capital gains tax, all change. I like change, he says. God, how long have we been stuck with this level? And now it's going to change again. Here we go. Come on, who's going to talk about the CGT changes and the impacts?
I'm just really glad that they didn't throw that one in at the same time that they threw the abolition of LTA in, because that would have, you know, the party that we were all having about LTA being changed would have been just double or double down. I'm not sure. But the capital gains tax changes, the allowance changes on those for the gains is probably one of the most significant things that I think that we've seen in the past, like 5 years, probably since Flexi Access really came to the forefront, because we've all been very used to the allowances that are available. It gave us quite a decent threshold on a really mass amount of clients that we work with. You know, the clients that we work with aren't low level by the majority, but that kind of allowance that we were used to was usually sufficient for most clients not to have to worry about a gain every year or a significant gain to pay every year. That's going to be thrown out the window now. So using allowances individually, like between a couple, absolutely is going to be key. We should do that anyway, but that's going to be even more key now. And if a financial planner is talking to an individual and they're married, certainly, or in a civil partnership, and the other person is not involved, that would be a significant question for me. It'd be a red flag. I would definitely push back on that kind of case. Both parties should be involved, not just from the allowance point of view. There's lots of other reasons, but that's like a major part of financial planning to me. But this is just, you know, it's going to be even more tricky. And I don't see how, if you didn't involve the other person, that you know, that would be amazing. Maybe a course complaint further down the line as well, if the financial planner hasn't pushed that with the client itself. So I think that's going to be a big thing.
I think so. The beauty of us, because we can actually see each other whilst we're recording the podcast, and the amount of head nodding that was going on, it was like head banging. It really was. It was like we're all listening to sort of some very heavy metal. The amount,
yes,
the
mass going
on. We can do that.
It'd be a different kind of podcast.
I'm sure, Rhys, you'd probably agree with that wholeheartedly, wouldn't you, in terms of where we are? And I think there'll be other things that we need to mention about this around consideration of other products in a moment. But that initial thing that Sian said there, Rhys, anything that you'd like to sort of add on the back of that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely agree. We've become, in many respects, I think, quite complacent with capital gains because it's only affected a certain amount of people, which is a very small amount of people. It's not particularly been a worry, for a long time, because we've got very, very used to these thresholds. The only thing, well, there's two things that I would add. The first is, if you have clients that are invested in either an MPS or a DFM service that are in a product that will give rise to a tax gain, you need to be having some serious conversations with them about what is their policy on rebalancing, more around ad hoc rebalances, because we saw a lot of those last year because of obviously the increased volatility and people wanting to increase, I won't go into the boring stuff, but increase their investments in equity and blah, blah, blah. But you need to know when they are going to happen and what consideration will they give to the client. That bit's probably more relevant to a DFM than an MPS. But you could end up with the client getting taxable events throughout the year that could affect any other planning that you were trying to do or anything that they were trying to do, first and foremost. So potentially, you know, before we go into products, maybe you want to be talking to clients about multi-asset solutions that'll take kind of a lot of the weight in that respect, or having real conversation with the client about how long term is this investment going to be. So I think one thing that is forgotten, particularly by clients and advisors, is that if you're paying capital gains tax, it's because you've made a gain. And I think we perhaps need to get back to, this is a very positive thing. What you are paying tax on is a game. It's not, you know, that someone's taking off you for fun. It's because you've made some money somewhere. So in some respects, you could argue that actually it isn't unfair, you know, for the tax account to take a cut from that. So again, I think it's conversations with the client about, right, okay, we've gone in kind of this world for so long. Now we're moving into a world where games are going to matter a lot more for more people. So have a bit more of a conversation at the very start. What are we actually trying to do here? And when a gain happens, there's going to be a tax to pay. Get them comfortable with it, educate them on how that works. And then, you know, as we talked about AISs and SEISs before, you can have those conversations a bit earlier in the day as well. It's just right.
And let's not move away from the fact that you still got a very positive tax alpha on capital gains.
Okay,
because you're not paying it at the higher rate. So, you know, you do have that very positive tax alpha. So it's still very, very important as part of that taxation planning. It's just, what are you looking for? Is it that growth, or is it for income? And maybe if it's more tax efficient income, then you need to consider what's the most suitable way of moving forward from an investment perspective, which probably brings me on to my next sort of part of that, which would have been bonds are dead, long live the bonds. Investment bonds, you know, never gone away from my perspective. I've always used them when I was planning, and I think, you know, very, very efficient in the way that you can use the tax efficiency for the right people at the right time. But I'm sure we're going to see more and more of investment bonds coming back into the planning forefront. That's my view. Sean Rees, I'm sure you've got lots of views on this one. And Rob, I know you will have as well, because looking at your technical insights, I think you've got Les Cameron coming around talking about bonds, I think, as well. So I know you've all got something to say about this. So who would like to add a little bit about bonds? Come on.
I'll go first, because as I mentioned already, you know, I'm a lover of trusts, which means that I've constantly dealt with bonds for years because I have that interest in it, and a lot of people don't. So that makes me a bit of a specialist in that. But then so dealing with them regularly, that's probably the key to being really comfortable with them, because if you're thrown one once every 6 months, you know, an existing one especially, to have a look at, you're going to not know what to do. So getting really comfortable with them on a constant basis is a really key thing. For me, they've never gone away. There's always been, like, the jury's been out on, there's no scientific way to decide if you've got a client with £1 million, how do you split it between different wrappers? There's no scientific way to do that, or prescribed way to do it. It's very much down to each individual financial planner or each firm's interpretation of how you should split that money. And it's always, for me, been a bit of, like, you know, finger in the air. What do I think? Let's think about the CGT. What kind of portfolio that's unwrapped might create a CGT liability? And that's now decreased quite rapidly. So I think bonds definitely need to be brought back into consideration. It's a bit of a tricky one, because it does add complexity to a client. So the client needs to be really okay with that. You know, if you're the problems that you see is, if you're justifying a transfer of, I don't know, 5 pensions for simplicity, but then you're creating 5 products in total for the client, is that really simpler? You know, it is, but it's kind of just going further, just really taking that what you're writing down, the justification you're using, even further on that front. And then the other problem, I think, is providers of these of investment bonds as well, as finding a good one, finding a cost effective one. That's going to be the key thing, and I can probably, I hope for movement in that kind of the provider space on that, for there to be good providers, to be much more of an offering to clients on that one. So that's what I'm hoping for.
So you think there might be some charge pressure on some of them, which can be.
And service pressure as well. You know, there's only a few, well, I would say a few, yeah, maybe a few platforms that have an investment bond on the platform. I'm not talking about a third party one that they have to connect to, but yeah, and that's really, certainly what I see as being, you know, if you're trying to make it simple, if you're bringing that into it and you're involving a platform and then a third party bond provider, that is not as simple as it could be. But then you've got that cost pressure as well. So it's about making it as easy as it possibly could be.
Yeah. Rhys, anything that you'd like to add to that?
Well, I completely agree, particularly on the provider side of things. I mean, it's just my opinion, and I'm happy to be wrong in it, but I found that over the years, there's a lot of providers who have lost interest in bonds to the point where they're barely mentioning them when I'm speaking to them. We like platforms that will house a bond. For simplicity, if you are going to bring a bond in, it does help if you can still keep everything on the same platform, just under different tax wrappers. But no, what Sean's saying about there not being an exact science on when to use a bond, I think that that's something that we have struggled with in the past. But I think that may get slightly easier now because we've got this, this capital gains barrier that's kind of getting closer, especially, if not next tax year, the tax year after, that we can use. But it's also, again, like I was saying with the VCT, but it's having conversations with clients about what do you actually want to do with this money? Because I'll mention the consumer duty, and that's the last time anyone mentions it today, but the consumer duty outcome-based advice, if somebody wants to invest £100,000, I think rather than what we used to do in sort of back in the day where you'd invest £100,000, it's, well, why? What are you doing it for? Well, I want it to grow. That's fantastic. But what's the end game? What do you want it to grow for? Is it for your retirement? Is it to give your kids whatever? And that can lead to better conversations about using a bond. One thing that we do quite regularly here is, as part of our ongoing service, the Better Nicer. Better Nicer is now, because of advancements in platform technology, so easy to do. Some of them, you can do them signatureless. Is that the word? Without a signature. But they're so easy to do now. If there's any tax implications from the collective investment account, before anybody pushes any buttons, you have got to be absolutely certain that that's going to be the correct thing to do. And if it's not going to be, again, we can kind of go into what's going to be the best product to use. If you're not going to be able to do a Better Nicer by going into an OEIC, there might be better ways of building up tax efficient income using a bond. I'd completely agree. It would be nice if we could get some cost pressure on a bond. Would be good for providers. I think that would help, and also them taking more of an interest perhaps when we're speaking to them. That was a long answer, wasn't it? But yeah, that's kind of where we are at the moment. It's just making sure you have that conversation with the client or the financial planner does. What do you want to do with this money? And then I would hope that would more easily lead between an ISA, an OEIC, and a bond or anything else that you might want to invest in.
And I think it's really easy to forget because, and Reece, you sound like you work with very similar clients to what I do. I just go, okay, well, obviously everybody uses cash flow planning. Everybody talks about objectives and real, timescales about how the money's going to be invested and when it might be needed and what it might be needed for. But not every financial planner does that. And I know not every power planner pushes back on getting enough information to make a really solid recommendation. So that's that. We mustn't forget that that's not, what we deal with is not necessarily everybody's experience.
And I think, Rob, I'm going to come to you in a second on this one, because I think you've got a very important role in terms of the power planner support in this, in terms of where I'm just going to sort of, my mystic Meg, as I always like to be, and always have been, is trying to have an idea of where the market's going to go in the next sort of like 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And there's three things at the moment that I think that are happening. Obviously, we've seen the tax changes and the reduction in CGT. We've got a review of income retirement or income in retirement and later life planning going on from the FCA at the moment. And they want to see more joined up thinking about making sure that people do look at alternative sources for income and not just at a pension plan per se. Okay. The third part of that, I think, and you've got to think about the consumer duty in avoiding foreseeable harm and looking at the best outcomes for clients. And that means I think that from a planning perspective, it does mean we're going to have to look at more different areas of products and solutions than perhaps we have done historically. And as a result of that, if you have been narrow in your choice within your planning, it probably means you need to widen it up. And then part of that becomes, do you have enough knowledge to open it up? And the bit I'm coming on to, Rob, is that then that's where the, you know, professional paraplanner and their insights can make a huge difference in that, in allowing paraplanners to get that extra knowledge that they need and that extra resource that I need. So you do have some insights coming up, haven't you? Some technical insights.
Yeah, we've got technical insights seminars coming up starting April, going through into December actually this year. Yeah, and a couple of things we've got, as you mentioned, we've got Les Cameron from M&G Wealth, ex-Pru as it used to be. He's actually going to be talking about tax in general. So some of the things we've been talking about today, but we've also got a Q&A with him, which should be quite interesting, as people can ask questions from the floor and he'll use his knowledge to answer. We do also have something on the investment bonds, and how they're used in a client's investment journey. So that would look at tax and estate planning too. And we look at, you know, pension planning and all those kind of things as well. So yeah, I mean, very much it is, you know, technical insight, because that's what it's meant to do, is give insights into all these things.
Okay. All right. I think I think the time to go to pensions and retirement planning. I think for once, a jaw-dropping moment for me when they said they were going to abolish the lifetime allowance. I don't think I saw any forecasts from any commentators to say that was going to happen. I saw maybe a reintroduction, sort of 1.8 million, maybe 1.85, but not the abolition. So some major changes. Where would we like to start on this one? Sean or Rhys, should we start with the lifetime allowance, then go to the annual allowance? And
that sounds good, I think.
There, so.
Yeah, and with lifetime allowance, yeah, absolutely jaw-dropping moment. And I think, you know, most paraplanner chat groups that afternoon was going to be about that exact thing. I've heard of in open offices, there was a gasp very loudly when that was announced. So it was, yeah, very interesting change in the legislation, probably the most interesting of the lot, because it seems like a real headline grabber. But I don't know about you, Rhys, but the number of clients that I've worked with over the years, and I've worked with really high net worth clients that have got over £2 million in a pension, I can count them on one hand. You know, this is not a big problem out there. Planning for it, yeah, that is an issue, and we get involved in that quite a lot. We have got involved in quite a lot. But actually, these people that are subject to these LTAs, they're small. It's a small number of them, so it's not as big as it might seem. It's a good political thing, I think, to cover, but it doesn't really make much difference. Makes our life a lot easier, not having to plan for LTA. That's the major thing to think about, I think, because I've got involved in it quite a lot over the past few years, planning what to do best to tackle LTA. You know, it's not about trying to move money from one place to another necessarily, but it's I've certainly found that a lot of clients, I end up writing the report because a client has read something, has heard from their friend, has been influenced that, oh, I can't keep money in the pension because I'm going to be subject to the LTA. And it's like, well, yeah, but if you get it out, that's income tax, and then that's IHT, and that doesn't put you in a better net position. It actually makes it worse, but they still need something from their financial planner in writing that shows them all the various cash flow with lots of numbers, which is where I would come in and produce something for them. So it's good to know that kind of we don't have to do that kind of stuff that wasn't going to cause a problem anyway, and we don't need to think about it going forward. Although it's going to still be a minefield of remembering things like the tax-free cash is going to be fixed, so it doesn't really matter like what the pension, what the LTA is you're using. You're not using that anymore, but it doesn't really matter what that is, because that tax-free cash is always going to be fixed. But then probably the biggest thing that I've ended up talking about since this announcement is the political risk that's involved then of now planning forward with no LTA, and the political risk that might not always be the case. So things like breaking protections that should be can be done, and it might be beneficial for the client to do that. But it's always thinking about what if suddenly that LTA comes back in and there's no protection, so then the client's worse off. It's thinking about those different types of scenarios. And I would, if I was doing that planning, doesn't necessarily mean we wouldn't break the protection, but I would be basically doing cash flow or planning on this is what happens if you break the protection, this is what happens if you don't, But actually, this is what happens if you break the protection and the LTA comes back in. I think it's doing it in a much safer way if possible.
Yeah, you're right in identifying that, because there's no guarantee that they go back to the previous protections if you broke them.
And no guarantee that they'll introduce any further protections. You'd think that they would, based on what they've done. But, you know, if we're talking a change in government, there is no standard procedure on what they might introduce and what they might have in place.
Yeah. Reese, anything else on the LTA and protections at this stage, or?
Not really. I mean, yeah, it is going to be a small number of people that this actually affects, which is worth remembering. It is a headline grabber, but you know, part of me does ask why, when it's not going to affect the vast majority of people ever, never mind the people now. You know, what I'm more interested in, I suppose, moving forward is what happens to it. You know, we talked about the political risk factors, but also what are they going to do with the PCLS? It's fixed at the moment, which is great, but how is that ever going to increase? Will it increase? You know, we were having a conversation here, you know, about the £1 million pension pot did become more popular, and it will still, you know, with inflation and wages constantly going up, and you know, with auto enrollment as well, there's everybody's paying into pensions now. So although, yeah, it was a headline grabber, and I can't tell you some of what was said in our office when we heard it, when you think about what is the actual effect of it moving forward, it could be fairly minimal. I mean, we've got a few people that are in SASSs that are going to be affected, but aside from that, a handful. So yeah, I suppose now it's more interested in, right, okay, what's going to happen moving forward? And as Sean pointed out, and as we've talked about the protections, I would be, you know, cautious before you do anything drastic with those. You know, if before the end of April everybody's broken their protection, or any protection that they've got, we could be in a right mess, you know, come the end of the year. So yeah, it's kind of, I suppose, just putting it into a bit of perspective. Yes, massive change. No one saw it coming. As you said, there was no commentary about it. But what does it actually affect? Probably not a lot at the beginning. And then we'll just have to see how it, because it does feel like, without going too far into politics, one of those bits of legislation that could be backtracked and very quickly. And it's...
And I think from what we've already seen, I think what we've already seen in the press and whatever, and you have used the consumer duty argument, but I am sure, and again, Mystic Meg, head on here, I am sure you will have somebody that actually breaks their protections, maybe then something reimposed, and they have a higher tax charge, and they're going to take a claim through on the fact that you haven't avoided foreseeable harm, because it's in the press and it could happen and you haven't mentioned it. So make sure whatever you do that it has that many caveats in, that the client is absolutely aware of the implication of what they have done and what it could be if things change, is the bit I'm going to say to that one. I think there's more excitement in the changes in annual allowances. And I say that because, believe it or not, I actually wrote an article. Sorry, Rob, it wasn't one for you, but I've actually just written an article that I had ready to go before the budget on the use of annual allowances and carry forward of unused relief. Brilliant, I said. Boy, did I have to change that very quickly on the budget. But I'd heard the noise, so I didn't send it in. But I think there's some great planning opportunities from the increase in annual allowances. So let's pick that one up. Reese, do you want to add a little comment to that one? And Rob, I'm sure you're going to have lots of interesting things on this one as well. So Reese,
yeah, absolutely. You know, we've got quite a sort of large pool of corporate clients where, you know, kind of the movement from 40 to 60 is great for them. The being moved back to 10,000 as well as a minimum. Again, it's that bit is all good news. It's all good news. I mean, I'll be honest with you, a lot of our clients, if you ask them what the MPAA was, they wouldn't know anyway. But also the threshold being moved up as well, you know, before we even have to think about the MPAA is very, it's all good news from that perspective, from a financial planning point of view. I suppose with the carry forward as well, I mean, the amount that you'll be able to put in the next tax year, you know, if you haven't used any of your pension input, again, fantastic opportunities for planners. But I suppose the only thing that I kind of would say on that as well is, as we move forward now, this is kind of a headline, because when the MPAA came in, it felt quite quiet. Sorry, when the tapering annual allowance came in, it felt quite quiet. Again, how many people it affects. But we've been using these terms for too long, like the maximum you can put into your pension is £40,000. That's all that you can put in. Have you used your full allowance? And I think now we've got a good opportunity to say to people, look, that's not the maximum that you can put in. You can actually put in whatever the hell you like. There's no limit to it. It's just how much you'll get tax relief on. And then speaking to your employer, if they've got a scheme, will they take up the tax charge? Because some will, particularly with some larger employers, that they'll take up any additional charges that you've got. But it still could be a very tax efficient vehicle of investing. It is still a pension contribution. So yeah, all good news. And also bringing pensions to more of a conversation piece with clients, because clients are talking about pensions now. I think it could be good, again, just to use it as a bit of an educational piece as well. And go, well, what do you actually want to do with this money? Oh, I can't put any more into my pension. You can. It's just, what does it mean to you from a tax perspective? So that's the conversations that we've been having at the moment. That side of it is all very good news. You know, anytime you can increase what you can put into something, that's got to be good news in my eyes.
Yeah. Sean?
Yeah, I mean, the main focus of all of these changes from the government's point of view is to get people to not make decisions about stop working and coming out of work for the reasons of LTA and things like that. So is that really a decision that people make? I mean, I don't know. I know that the doctors have been talked about quite a lot here, and that's probably the experience that I've had, is having to think about those kind of individuals, that kind of profession, when it comes to tapered annual allowance, when it comes to LTA. There are serious effects that does have. I don't know how much of a cause and effect it has in terms of people leaving, or whether it will influence decisions about staying in the profession or coming back to it, which is what obviously the political message is from it. So I think it's quite interesting. And I think tapered annual allowance, it affects a lot of people. I see more cases than not of people that have been affected by it, but have no idea that they're affected by it. And then you end up rewinding, going back a few years, having to claim or talk to HMRC about paying tax charges that you didn't declare because you didn't know, and things like that. So that's not gone away. That headache is still here. It's changed slightly, going back up to 10, which is nice. But yeah, it's still going to be a headache for us going forward. It's just giving a bit more of an allowance to people, which makes, you know, changes the planning that we do, keeps us all in a job. Not gone away at all.
It takes
the LTA issue out of it as well, because for these are individuals that earn a lot. So they are people that have big pension pots. So we always had the debate of, okay, well, you're restricted by putting into your pension, but that's probably a good thing, because you don't want to max out your LTA, or don't want to go over it too much. Really, maybe, you know, as long as you're doing something else with your money, that's going to be tax efficient, where it's like, no, actually, pile it into your pension as much as you possibly can, especially if you've got employer contributions that you can make use of because of the, you know, it not being impacted by the earning side of things. So there's all those sorts of different things to think about. I think that's the bit that, where we've lost the complexity of LTA, we've still got it with tapered annual allowance. That'll keep you busy enough.
Absolutely right. You've still got the tapered annual allowance, and like you say, it hasn't gone away, and you've still got to be mindful of that. And also, if you are going to use carry forward, the fact that you've still got to do your check for tapered annual allowance, because it's carry forward of the previous tapered annual allowance.
Yeah.
So you've got to work all of that out if you are going to think about using the carry forward and for an increased amount as well. So it makes that a little bit more complex around the timings of rules as well. So again, you just need to be mindful of all of that as well. Rob, anything that you want to add into that?
I think the MPAA was quite an interesting, for me it's quite interesting because I think it does introduce a degree of flexibility, particularly for those who maybe want to, to ease into retirement, who want to take some income and want to draw down income and therefore will be affected by it. So the increase to 10,000, I think, is a good move. It shouldn't prevent you from, you shouldn't be prevented from saving for retirement if you then, want to take some income from your pension. I think also probably it's going to help some of the employers keep people on. So I think that, the tighter labour market at the moment. So hopefully it will help towards that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if you think about the driver for those in public sector schemes and in the NHS, there are a couple of other rules that came in around calculating pension inputs as well that you perhaps need to read up on if you've got clients in those areas. That just allow you to align a couple of if you've got more than one scheme in terms of transferring negatives to positives. So just be mindful of those. But I think, again, from our perspective, from the power planning thing, it's know the changes, isn't it, really? And how it impacts on the clients that you deal with on a day to day basis. I can still talk about taxation and all things positive for hours if you get me going. So I know we've taken a little bit longer than we normally would. So before I wrap up, is there anything else that anybody wants to add? Reese, Sean, Rob?
Probably the one main thing that I would say going forward, you've just said, make sure you know the changes. Make sure you know the changes and make sure that your reports after 6th of April are accurate, because don't rely on somebody else to be changing wording and things like that. Make sure you're reading it from start to finish. We haven't had to do that for a long time with template wording, I don't think. And a lot of us use systems and things to create our suitability reports. Read everything, because if you're relying on systems or somebody else to update it, you're going to fall foul of things, I think.
Reece? Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, from next week, we're going to be talking to our planners about when are they going to be presenting suitability reports. So obviously we might print them next week, but they are going to be presented after the session. So making sure that's they are up to date is paramount. But also, if you're using any cash flow forecasting tools, it's making sure that even if you have to give them a call and just ask them when are you planning on making the changes, or are you making sure that those outputs are still going to be correct. And I suppose the other thing, know the changes is very important. But I think you've got to get to a point where you're very confident in the changes, enough to challenge if somebody doesn't. Because in the power planner world, sometimes you come up against an advisor who can be quite strong. If they haven't done the research, you've got to know that you are right and then have that discussion. And also, it's always good to have some proof on hand. Have a PDF that you can email them instantly, just to go, have you checked this? They're the only bits that I would add.
Yeah, we've had those conversations about those advisors in the past, and there certainly are some podcasts, particularly about the stronger advisors, and certainly those with 20 years of 1 year's experience. He says that's never changed. It's always entertaining. Rob, if people want anything more on the technical insights on power planners, when they are and what's in them, where can they get that information from?
It's all on the website under the events tab.
Okay. All right. There we go. So if you want more information and want to know and want some more learning, and even though it may not be a requirement to do CPD, if you want to do CPD as well, then the Technical Insights, and they're all around the country as well. That's the one thing I would say. They are all around the country as well. So I think I attended a couple last year, and they were really really informative. So again, if you get the opportunity and you're allowed to go, use them. They're there for you.
Rich, it's just worth pointing out here that it depends on your professional body membership, but some of them do need CPD for you to keep your letters and membership and things like that. So that's something to keep in mind, that although, for power planners, mostly in their firms, they won't actually need to record CPD. They might not even be asked about it. But actually, for their memberships with their professional body, they will need to record it and prove it sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have the same thing with LIBF in our chartered status, that that you need to actually achieve the CPD as well. So yeah, well said, Sean. Well said on that one. Okay, so I think from my point of view, a really, really good discussion. I think there's lots that power planners can take out from this. Thank you very much. And we'll be back next month with a new podcast. So have a wonderful end of the year and have a wonderful new tax year on the 6th of April as well. So thank you very much, Sean. Thank you very much, Reese. And thank you very much, Rob.